Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and today we're talking extra virgin olive oil and controversy. Extra virgin olive oil is the purest of olive oils and the finest tasting. But if those words are on the label, are they a guarantee of what's in the bottle? And if it's from a farm in Tuscany, is it the real thing? And how can one bottle of extra virgin olive oil cost $10 and another bottle cost $70? Well, much is going to be revealed when we talk with investigative journalist Tom Mueller, author of Extra Virginity. Stay with us for this and much more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Buy romance when we buy extra virgin olive oil. Artisans working old olive mills, pressing fresh-picked fruit, that first flow of bright green oil, and that'll be $70 a bottle. Olive oil is a global business. There's lots of money to be made, but there are also many questions left unanswered. Well, journalist Tom Mueller has written Extra Virginity, the sublime and scandalous world of olive oil. Tom, welcome.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
So, Tom, I want to talk to you about how to buy a good olive oil. But first, can you explain what extra virgin means?
Yes. Extra virgin, virgin oil means simply that it's been produced with mechanical means, with physical crushing and spinning out the oil or pressing it. You can't use chemistry and you can't use high heat to produce virgin oil. Now, extra virgin simply means the highest quality grade of virgin oils. There is also virgin, and lampante virgin, which is from the Italian word for lamps, lamp oil, which can't be sold as food. And as a matter of fact, the bar for extra virgin olive oil quality is fairly low. Essentially, the law says that apart from some chemical tests, it has to remind you in odor or in taste of fresh olives, mm-hmm. and it can't have any defects. The typical defects defined by the law are rancidity and fustiness, which is a kind of fermented taste, and earth, which is dirty olives, and so on, each connected to a flaw in the oil-making process. But it doesn't say that it has to have any positive attributes apart from reminding you of olive fruit. So it's a fairly low bar, but nonetheless, a lot of oils don't clear it.
So where does the corruption come in?
Well, like anything that has an inherently high value, true extra virgin olive oil is expensive to produce. You have to get good fresh fruit. You have to press it quickly, store it properly. The harvest costs are very high because you're rushing the fruit from the trees to the mill. And ultimately, that bottle of oil may cost you $4, $5, $6, $7, $8 a liter just to produce and before you even put it in a bottle. Mm-hmm. Now, other vegetable oils can quite easily be mixed with that, or low-grade olive oil that's been deodorized. It's a low-temperature refining process that removes the bad smells and also the nutritional benefits and the taste benefits. And the lower-grade oils like this can be mixed with a little bit of real extra virgin and sold as extra virgin. Unfortunately, the level of oversight in the olive oil industry, especially in America, but also elsewhere, is quite low. And for that reason, it's pretty easy to get away with fraud.
Yeah, so the idea that this happens mainly in Italy is really not true, right?
Completely false. And in fact, Unfortunately, the laxity of the FDA is part of the reason why it's significantly more prevalent in America than it is in Italy. Certainly, it's a problem across the Mediterranean, particularly deodorized oil is a problem worldwide because while it's still made from olives, you've lost a lot of the reason why you would buy it in the first place, if thinking you're getting extra virgin. But America is a particularly bad market, especially since it's growing so fast, 10% per year consumption growth, and 300 million consumers is a very tempting place to sell your oils.
Well, okay, now it's time to name names. What should we buy, for instance, in supermarket oils? What are the brands we should look for?
Well, the two that I know that I can recommend in America that are widely distributed in America are Corto Olive and California Olive Ranch. Corto Olive I've seen in Costco for 2 liters for $15. And California
That's
Olive Ranch.
That's amazingly inexpensive.
It's remarkably inexpensive. Great oil does not have to be horribly expensive. There are efficient companies like California Olive Ranch and Corto that produce very good oil with machinery that is used for wine harvesting but also for olive oil making. It's a modified, which can be very efficient and produce first-rate general-purpose oils, oils that, as these two companies say themselves, are intended to compete favorably with the big name supermarket oils that we're all familiar with and win convincingly.
So what about, for instance, Whole Foods brand olive oil, their 365 brand
olive oil? I've been very disappointed, to tell you the truth, in the 365 oils that I've tasted. I've found the traditional defects that you expect to find in substandard oil, and yet it's marked as extra virgin. Huh. Now, it's important to remember that how an oil was produced doesn't necessarily guarantee that the oil you buy and take home is going to be excellent, because in the process it's passed through a lot of hands, and a given store manager could mishandle the oil, put it in the sun or keep it past its best buy date and ultimately sabotage the quality of the oil. So there's no guarantee that what I was getting when I got 365 brand was representative
right.
of the Whole Foods store brand, but I've tried it in different places and I've been regularly disappointed in the quality.
There are two other supermarket brands that are very popular, Carapelli and Colavita. What's mm-hmm. your take on both of those?
These are traditional supermarket oils that are typically made from oils from around the Mediterranean. Now, Colavita does say it's 100% Italian, and that may well be true. But ultimately, they are so high volume that it's difficult to achieve premium quality oil with the kind of turnover they have. Carapelli in particular is owned by a Spanish company, and a lot of the, you can tell from the scent of the oil that it's made from Picual olives in Andalusia. So Carapelli is a Florentine name and a Florentine tradition, but the actual oil you get is pretty low-grade Spanish oil.
Mm-hmm. One splurge oil, if we could only have one oil and we were going to make a big splurge, what would it be?
I would buy Castillo de Canena, which is a Spanish oil, as a matter of fact, exactly the same cultivar or type of olive that Carapelli uses, Picual, but it's made properly by a brother and sister team in the heart of Andalusia who makes an absolutely magnificent poetic oil. And it's widely available in fine stores, and it should be more widely available. If there's any justice in the world, it will be.
Tom, thank you. You have done good work for olive oil.
I hope the good work continues because there are many Castilla de Canenas out there and Frantoio Franchis and others who need to be celebrated and known better. And the other guys, the big companies know how to make great oil too. Until now, they've said, well, we're a volume, we're about volume. But volume, ultimately, is not making them any money anymore either. And I think there may well be a shift, a generalized shift, towards cleaning up their act in the future.
I hope so, too. And Tom, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you, Lynn. This is great.
Tom Muller is author of Extra Virginity, The Sublime and Scandalous World of Olive Oil. Now, you can find Tom's olive oil picks on the website, splendidtable.org. Whatever it is about the word soup, put it into the title of a cookbook and we're already anticipating the hot bowl, the hunching of the shoulders to hold in the warmth. Well, vegetarian food writer and filmmaker Anna Thomas wrote a favorite book of mine. It's called Love Soup, a book entirely devoted to the subject. Producer Sally Swift sat down to talk with her about one of her concoctions that's perfect for this time of year.
Hi, Anna. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So I was very intrigued by an article that you wrote on green soups. Can you tell me the story behind them?
Well, you know, I've been making these green soups, and there are a number of them. It's a whole category of soup. And I've been making them for years and years now, but I remember when it really got started for me. And it's when I had this little house up in Idlewild in the mountains, and my son was going to school there, and we used to go up there, and cold in the winter up in the mountains. And it was one of those gray, cold days, not one of those beautiful winter days, but one of those damp, awful winter days. And the holidays were over, and my jeans were tight because I'd eaten too many cookies. And, you know, I just felt, ugh, I needed to do something. And thank God I had been to the farmer's market, and I had all these greens in the refrigerator. So I did the thing that every Polish cook does. I started cutting up onions. I mean, that's how you start everything, right? And I started cutting up onions and sautéing them and caramelizing them, and I started washing my greens, and I thought, this is going to be a soup. And I made a soup out of, it was probably kale and chard and maybe spinach. Maybe it was the Triple Crown, my favorite, you know, combination. And it was so wonderful. I felt so much better right away. You know, I really felt great. And it was delicious. And I started making versions of that soup all the time. I ate it all winter. I thought, this is fantastic. This is my new diet plan. More green soup, less of everything else.
Is it medicinal for you at all?
You know, it feels like the greatest tasting medicine in the world. I mean, they were very simple green soups. They didn't have a lot of complication, a lot of ingredients, but they had a ton of greens.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit, because it's not as simple. You have a real technique for this, and you have actually come up with a basic green soup base that you can riff
yeah.
on. But I want you to talk yeah. through that, because you have a couple things that I think are interesting. Namely, one are those caramelized onions, and the second is rice.
Yeah.
So talk us through quickly
yeah.
that basic soup.
Yeah. I caramelized a couple of onions. I cut them up and I really, you know, put them in with just a little bit of olive oil in a pan and took my time. This is one of those things you do while you're answering your email. You know, you don't have to be paying that much attention, but you have to let it have the right amount of time. I always tell people, when you think you're done caramelizing those onions, go another half hour.
So slow, slow heat. A little bit of fat and slow, slow heat.
And cover them to sweat them a little and keep the moisture in, because you don't want them drying out so much that they burn before they have time to really soften up and caramelize. What you'll end up with is sort of an onion jam. And all you've done is put onions in a little olive oil with a pinch of salt.
Mm-hmm.
You haven't added anything. They just turn into this lovely, dark, rich, caramelly colored sort of onion marmalade.
So you get
the onions
going.
Are going. You wash up all your greens. If it's kale, you take it off the stems. If it's spinach, you just cut it up. Chard, you know, your call. You can take it off the stems or not. And, you know, you use a lot of greens. I usually ask for about at least two big bunches of greens mm-hmm. in a pot of soup. And it's fantastic. And then some water and some vegetable broth. This makes some of its own vegetable broth, so you don't have to add a ton. And those 2 or 3 tablespoons of arborio rice. It cooks in with the greens, it turns very soft, and when you puree the whole thing, you know, when you put your immersion blender in there and you puree it all, it gives the soup this silky, creamy texture. And of course, there's no cream in it, but it has this wonderful velvety texture from that I love. And then I season it. A little sea mm-hmm. salt, a little pepper, a pinch of cayenne, and always a little bit of lemon juice. And how much just depends on, you know, how sour your lemons are.
Mm-hmm.
It is such a great soup. And then what I do is when I cook it, I don't use too much olive oil in the actual cooking process. But when I serve the soup, I drizzle a little bit of unheated olive oil on top. And the taste of that fresh olive oil that has not been heated is entirely different. It's the juice of the olive And it just is wonderful. It completely wakes up all the flavors in the soup.
That soup sounds simply delicious. Thank you for joining us, Anna.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here.
Anna Thomas is author of Love Soup. Now, you can find Anna's basic green soup and her kale and sweet potato version, which, by the way, is just killer, on the website splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, download our Key 3 podcasts, check out our recipes, register for our book giveaway, and sign up for our free e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. Each week, we send you a recipe to help make your worknight suppers a little easier and more fun. It's all there. SplendidTable.org. We're going to be back with Modern Family's Ty Burrell, who is up as our celebrity guest stumpmaster. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. It is time to play Stump the Cook, the Splendid Table Refrigerator Game. Now, here's how it works. A listener calls in with five things in their fridge, and I have to come up with a dish from those five ingredients that the caller would really eat. But the final judgment comes from our celebrity guest Stumpmaster. And this week, it is the Emmy Award-winning actor Ty Burrell, a.k.a. Phil Dunphy of Modern Family. Ty, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Ty, tell me something. Does Phil Dunphy cook?
Phil cooks a little bit. You know, most of the stuff, it has Claire cooking. But I think, you know, judging by other Phil actions, he probably thinks he's pretty good. That's my guess.
He's such a fascinating character.
Yeah.
I mean, really, he's this incredible combination of almost a poignant sort of wanting to be so much. And
I guess maybe that's kind of a general trend in fathers recently, but he it definitely is kind of a big boy, or a talking dog in a way.
Hey, do you cook by any chance?
I do. I'm not great. My wife is the foodie in our house. I have kind of a goat palate, but I try, and I love to eat. So you know, she just tells me what I'm tasting.
I understand. Understand. Now, you know, not to press the food angle, but what is the role that you're playing in your new film?
Oh, in Butter?
Yeah.
I'm playing the husband of Jen Garner, and I'm the 15-time champion. Actually, in the film, it's the world champion, which is what you do regionally when nobody else is competing with you. Champion butter carver of Iowa.
Do you actually get to carve butter in the film?
We did a little bit. Yeah, it was really fun. They brought in the sort of reigning champion, and he kind of taught us as fast as he could before the butter melted, because we couldn't do it in a refrigerator. mine looked horrible, but luckily that's movie magic. They made it look good.
Yeah, the shot is on you and not necessarily on the sculpture.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just me with a trowel looking amazing, looking very fast and agile.
Okay, we're going to play Stump the Cook. Now, our contestant is Florence from St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Florence, are you there?
Hi, Florence.
Yes, I am.
I understand that you're into food.
Yeah, my husband and I, together with another couple, own a restaurant here in St. Johnsbury. And we also own a graphic design business, and we've been designing the Art of Eating publication for the last 25 years.
Oh, for goodness sakes. I think I'm in trouble. All right. Here's the deal. Five things in your refrigerator. And the other thing is, now, I get salt and pepper. These are the free things. Water. Okay. And then three free ingredients, only if you have them on hand.
Okay.
All right. So fire away, girl. What have you got?
Here it is. Okay. And this is really and truly what was in the refrigerator. So
I'm bracing myself. I can only imagine.
Okay. Yeah, well, you're going to love it.
Okay.
Let's see. I'll start with a 5-hour energy drink. Great.
Wow, that's a way to kick it off.
Yeah. And then we move right into the tofu section of the refrigerator. Okay. Firm tofu, just plain.
Tofu.
And then a jar of homemade apple butter that we had just made from some local Vermont apples.
Apple butter.
Some smoked trout from Maine.
smoked trout. Okay.
And then a bunch of fresh jalapenos.
Thai?
Yeah, my palate is just dull enough that I'm imagining all of this in a bowl.
What I'm wondering is if I decide to retire from this show right now, do you think there's a place for me in the craft services on your show?
Absolutely. And by the way, what she just described is our craft services.
It is? Oh.
Just open a bottle of 5 hours.
Yeah, that's
right.
Basically what you want on the crafty table.
I never thought I'd ever ask this question of anyone, but what does a 5-hour energy drink taste like?
I don't drink them. It's actually my husband, but he opens it up and it smells like grape coffee.
It tastes like hope, is my guess.
Yeah.
Tastes like optimism.
there you go.
All right, Lynn, just think positively about all of this. You've got the sparkle of the pepper. You've got the richness of the smoked trout. You've got the sweetness of the apple butter. Those three right there are great. I know what we're going to do. Okay. Have you got butter?
Yes, absolutely.
You have butter. Have you got onion?
Oh, yeah.
You've got onion. That's two things.
Yep.
Okay. We're making a version of chopped liver, but we're going to do a smoked trout bastardized version of a pâté, okay? This is going to be sort of a lovely kind of little spread, okay?
Sure.
So you're going to do a lot of browned onion in butter with salt and pepper, and you're going to puree that with a nice amount of that smoked trout, a little bit of the apple butter for a hint of sweetness, and some fresh lemon. That's the third ingredient.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to balance it with the fresh lemon. You're going to mince up some of the fresh jalapeno to give it sparkle. And the tofu is going to go in there, not a large amount, but the tofu is going to go in there for creaminess.
Right.
And it's really neutral, but it's firm tofu, and it's going to give it a nice amount of body.
Right.
And then what's going to happen is you're going to take 1 teaspoon or 2 teaspoons of the energy drink and puree it into this mousse, because no one will know it's there.
Oh,
and
man.
I've used it. And you're
going to
take nice plates, and you're going to put just little ovals on each plate and put some crackers, and it'll look so elegant, and people will be able to then spread it. And I am working so hard on this. Guys, I don't know
if you can actually hide an ingredient. Can you?
I think
you can. Can
you
actually just take the 5-hour energy bottle and just hide it under the table?
Well, Florence, would you make this? Your judgment?
Sure. I mean, my family is up for most anything on any day, and the fact that it's a 5-hour energy drink, my husband will eat it, you know?
All right. Okay, Ty, you're the ultimate judge, and I can take anything you dish out.
As adjudicator, I approve. I can't imagine anything more palatable out of that collection of weirdness.
That's hilarious.
Thank you, guys. You are really kind beyond any measure that I can think of.
Thank you very much.
We probably won't be seeing this in your cookbooks anytime soon, though.
Well, I don't know. Minus the energy drink, we might, and the tofu, the thing might work.
Okay.
Florence, thank you so much for playing.
Well, thank you for having me.
And Ty, thank you so much, sir.
Thank you very much. I hope to talk to you again.
Take care. You, too, can play Stump the Cook. Call us, 800-537-5252. Send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org and tell us about your 5 ingredients. And perhaps one of our clever and cunning producers will give you a call to play on the air. People know where they're going early on. Take Christian Di Benedetti. He graduated college, received a fellowship, and he did the logical thing. He used it to study traditional beer making in Europe and West Africa. Then he was mentored by legendary British beer writer Michael Jackson. And now he's a respected beer journalist with his first book, The Great American Ale Trail. Christian, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Christian, before getting into where you went and what you found, why did you pick West Africa to study beer making?
Oh, that is fascinating question, because West Africa is a place that subsists with millet and sorghum, two grains that are used, that are hardy enough to grow in that dry Sahel climate. And I had friends there working in the Peace Corps who could introduce me to village brewers making beer somewhat along the lines of beer that was made in Mesopotamia. So I had a chance to, you know, venture into villages and learn about beer making in a way that really hasn't changed in thousands of years. So it was absolutely fascinating.
Well, I'm thinking, what if you had a couple of pals and they said to you, we want to taste really good beer, but we'd like to have a bit of an adventure. We want to go to some of the unusual places and places off the beaten track.
Well, you know, it's almost pick the map and throw a dart and make your travels, because beer culture is alive and well everywhere. But one of the first that I like to talk about is Alaska. It's not easy to get to Alaska, but in mid-January, there is a huge beer and barley wine festival that brings together all the brewers of Alaska and the beer fans, and they get together in the dead of winter. And they taste these amazing beers that they make, you know, for each other and for their fans. And despite the fact that it's 15 degrees below zero, it's a great time. And then traveled to Juneau, where Alaskan Brewing Company is founded in 1986 by a couple of home brewing, friends who later married and now have the 12th largest brewery in the country and wonderful beer. That's Alaskan Brewing Company.
Now, what kinds of beer do they make?
You know, they're famous for several different styles there. Alaskan Amber is kind of the flagship. But one of the interesting beers that they're making up there is based on ship's logs from Captain Cook, who came ashore to harvest spruce tips when he was sailing up and down the western United States and made beer with spruce tips. So their winter beer is made in this way, and it's absolutely delicious and really reflects the place that it comes from, which is, to me, is a hallmark of the great beer scene we have in the country now. It's all about the place.
Okay, so what would be the next place you'd want us to go?
Well, I would say that against all odds, Los Angeles has become a great craft beer center now. And in Pasadena, there is a brewer named Mark Gilg from Craftsman Brewing Company, whose story is pretty amazing. He was a NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory scientist who discovered his, you know, love for beer. And he's really one of the pathbreakers who are changing the way people think about beer. So I would head to sunny L.A. when it's cold out and visit some of the amazing beer bars that are opening up now.
Well, what's so different about his beer?
You know, Mark's beer is very adventurous in that he is using ingredients that most brewers would be afraid to put in their beer, like white sage and like wild yeast called Brettanomyces, that is the bane of any winemaker. But brewers are doing adventurous things with their beer, and that includes putting wild yeast in, which bring really earthy, interesting flavor dimensions to beer. And not all of his beers reflect that, but certainly some of the most adventurous ones.
So you've talked about some people on the West Coast. Anybody on the other side of the country?
Absolutely. Sean Hill is an eighth-generation Vermonter working in the center of the state on a farmstead where his family has been for generations. And he's one of the young brewers who is poised to become the next big thing. He's adventurous. He'll try any style. And he's got mentors in the form of some of the best brewmasters in the world who have come over from Europe to mentor him. And his operation is growing. It's in the middle of the state. It's not easy to find. And he recommends that you bring GPS to make sure you don't get lost to find it out there.
So what might I taste if I could find him and I could sit down with him?
Yeah, and I recommend that you do find him, or at least his beer. You can find it in parts of the Northeast. You know, some of his beers are made with local honey, so you might taste some dryness from fermented out honey. You might taste some wheat from unmalted wheat. You might taste a peppery yeast strain. Some of these things are common with Belgian beers, but they're also taking on a new life of their own here in this country. And you may also even taste the effect of oak from wine barrels, which are used to age the beer, and they lend some fine tannins and some fine acids to balance out the beers.
Really unusual to age beer and to age it in wine barrels.
Yeah, you know, it is, but it's becoming more common. And in a way, it's really a throwback to the way all beer before stainless steel, and we have these fancy, shiny breweries everywhere. Well, you know, wood barrels were the vessel for aging beer, and they work well, but they do foster some, you know, benign bacteria that is completely fine to ingest, but it does lend the beer some different character, some, I would say, almost a wine-like character, some acids and some heft that that beers fermented in ordinary steel do not have.
Huh. Well, thank you for talking with us, Christian.
Thanks so much for having me.
Christian DiBenedetti has written The Great American Ale Trail. Now you can check out the website for his finds. That's splendidtable.org. Sterns, Jane and Michael, have bird dog instincts. You could blindfold them, put them in a place they have never been, and in moments they will find great eats and report them to their website, roadfood.com, and then come here to tell us all about them. Jane, Michael, welcome.
Hi, hey, Lynn.
So where have you been?
We were in Chicago, and we came across a place that I think the people who do love it are going to hate us for even mentioning it on the show.
Why?
Because it's already way too popular. And if you like what this place serves, you're going to have to wait in line for it already. It's called the Donut Vault.
The Vault?
And vault is actually too big a word to describe this place. It should be like the Donut Closet. Because this is probably the smallest restaurant.
The Donut Cubbyhole.
It's really... To call it a hole in the wall is exactly correct. I mean, in fact, its address even is fractional. Its address is 400 and a half North Franklin Street in Chicago, which if you know Chicago, it's right around the corner from the Merchandise Mart and great places like Gene and Georgetti's Steakhouse and Harry Carey's Steakhouse. This is, as the name suggests, a donut shop. That's all they have on the menu, plus coffee. There is no place to eat inside, but... an hour before they open in the morning, people start lining up to get their donuts. And they open at 8:30.
Right.
And when they run out of donuts, which might be 10, 10:30, 11 o'clock in the morning, they close.
Let me tell you a little bit about these donuts, because I think I made a million enemies on the show 10 years ago when I said that I thought Krispy Kremes were the most disgusting thing in the world.
We got a lot of mail, Jane.
You did,
yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
And I had a security guard with me for about a year.
Yeah.
But the fact is, my favorite donuts are cakey, old-fashioned donuts, not the light, greasy, fried ones. At the Donut Vault, they have old-fashioned buttermilk that has the crustiest surface you ever had. And they have chestnut donuts, chocolate, and vanilla. And a chestnut donut is probably the greatest invention since
I've never seen a chestnut donut.
I never have either. Is that brilliant?
Now, is it actually like chestnuts in the donut, or is it chestnut flour? What is it?
It's more in the glaze. I mean, I think it's more of like a sort of a sweet chestnut glaze on a buttermilk donut. I'm not sure there's actually chestnut in the donut itself.
It just has chestnut flavor. I mean, it almost sounds French, God forbid, you know, that it would be something you would get at, you know, the world's most expensive pastry shop in Paris. But the Donut Vault, if they have chestnut donuts on the menu for the day, make sure you get one.
But we did not mention the one other wonderful thing. It's called a gingerbread stack.
Oh, God,
and what gingerbread stack is, it's three little donuts. The regular donuts are pretty darn big. I mean, one is all you might want with your cup of coffee. But the gingerbread stack is three small donuts. I don't want to say mini because they're not that small. But three small donuts that are sugar crusted and they're gingerbread. And boy, are they good with a cup of coffee.
So this is a place that's essentially open maybe 3 or 4 hours a day. They do a handful of different donuts. What a way to run a business.
And it works great.
And if you want to see a really good piece of theater, get a box of donuts, because you have never seen donuts packed into a box faster than their counter help does.
By the way, that's counter help singular. There is one person who does everything and does it at lightning speed.
Guys, thank you.
All right, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn. Bye. Gina Michael Stern's site is roadfood.com. Well, the weekly trivia challenge is ready to go. And the question is, what is the one thing we can do to be healthier and happier? And I should give you a hint. The answer comes from the town with the highest level of well-being in the country. Well, we're going to be back with that answer. And you and I will talk. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to be talking with you in a moment, so get in touch. Friend us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org or call us, 800-537-5252. But before we talk, I have the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what is the one thing we can do to be healthier and happier? And the answer is never eat at a drive-through restaurant again. Now, I found this in the book Thrive by Daniel Buettner. In it, he looks at the places where people are the healthiest and most content, and he examines why they are. Well, one place is San Luis Obispo, and this is where they banned drive-throughs. The bigger picture here is that the town purposely shifted from being business-oriented to quality-of-life-oriented. And recently, a survey claimed that San Luis Obispo has the highest level of well-being in the country and a low obesity level. It is time to turn to your calls. Pick up that phone, 800-537-5252. Friend us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or send us an email, splendidtable.org. We've got Mark calling from Silver Springs, Maryland. Mark, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I am a home brewer, and I make lots of beer and cider. And sometimes, accidentally or on purpose, I make vinegar. If you let oxygen get to cider, acetobacter gets in there, and it turns the hard cider into vinegar. So I have a gallon of cider vinegar in my basement. And,
right.
And then also, I want to make a strong beer. Often as a byproduct, I end up with 2 to 4 liters, maybe a gallon of unhopped, kind of weak beer, 2 to 4% alcohol.
Right.
And I could make vinegar of that, but, you know, I can only eat so many fries and drink so much salad dressing. So I'm wondering, what can I do with gallons of vinegar? And I'm not that interested, actually, in meat answers because
I understand.
I haven't eaten meat in 30
years. Okay. All right. Well, first of all, you could do pickles. I do it all the time with cider vinegar for cheddar. I first had it in England with cheddar at an old country house hotel called Charlton House. And so I call it Charlton House Pickled Onions. And it was where you took cider vinegar and you took sliced red onions and brown sugar and salt and pepper and tarragon if you wanted. And the idea was that you did a layer of brown sugar at the bottom of a glass jar and then you put a layer of thin sliced onions and you kept doing that layer until you got to the top, and then you filled it with cider vinegar, and you put salt and pepper between the layers.
So would you can that in a water bath then?
Well, you didn't need to because you were marinating it, and you had a high acid cider vinegar. It was a 7% vinegar.
Oh, okay.
And you made sure it was constantly covered with that vinegar, and you kept it in a cool, dark place. And after about a week or two, you served those onions, which were very tart, with a really strong cheddar.
Nice.
So another thing you could do with it is, for instance, just flavor it any way you want. Okay, bring it to a boil. Pour it over thin sliced radishes or daikon radishes or cucumbers or that kind, and keep it in the fridge for a week or two.
And how about the malt vinegar?
Malt vinegar, the same thing.
Okay. What about reductions?
Reductions are fabulous. Absolutely fabulous. You've browned, you've done vegetables or whatever. Boil down that vinegar. You can make something called a gastrique, which is a French term, an unfortunate one, I think, because it's not very attractive sounding. But it's vinegar and sugar. And in this case, why not add some chopped up apples and garlic, okay, and whatever herbs you like, and you boil it down to a syrup.
It's kind of a chutney idea.
It's a chutney idea, but you don't have very much of the solids in it. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that that could go over beans, over, you know, greens.
Carrots,
over,
roast vegetables.
Yeah. You have it, exactly. And the other thing is you drizzle that over fresh cheese. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
Drizzle, streak that over fried eggs, if you eat eggs.
A dessert, maybe?
A dessert would be wonderful because that you have that. I would leave out the garlic.
Oh, yeah.
But the idea of the savory, sweet, that kind of thing.
Great.
And, yeah, and that is the sort of thing you can even stick in the refrigerator and have, you know, again for a couple of weeks and then warm it and drizzle it, and it's fabulous.
Okay.
There's a wonderful fish stew. Do you eat fish?
Occasionally.
Occasionally. There's a fish stew that begins with a lot of onions and a fair amount of vinegar that you cook down.
What's it called?
It's called a brodetto, which is a generic term for fish stews in a particular part of the Adriatic in Italy.
Brodetto.
But you chop up a lot of onions, you take about a half a cup of vinegar, you put it in a pot, and you cook that down slowly. And the onions pick up the vinegar almost disappears. And then you add tomatoes, and then you add, you know, garlic, and then you add herbs, and then you simmer that, and it has this, you can't pinpoint the flavor. But it's there, and then you can put that aside for a day or two in the fridge, and when you're ready to have your stew, you cook the fish in at the last minute.
Oh, research that.
Yeah, it's really great. It happens to be in a book called The Splendid Table that I wrote in 1992.
Imagine that.
Well, it's an old, old recipe. I'd never seen the technique used before. It's very strange. And it's a great thing to try with other things, too, with a vegetable stew.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mark.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Vinegar, you know, we overlook what you can do with this, and it was one of the oldest. I mean, if you went back before Christ, people were using vinegar, and they were using it to preserve, but they were also using it for flavorings. And it's one of the oldest sauces, also, the vinegar-based sauces. You see it all through history. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. We've got Kathy calling from Burnsville, North Carolina. Kathy, what is on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This is exciting. I love single malt scotch, but don't buy it that often for a lot of reasons. But the other day I went into the store to buy what I usually get, and the clerk pointed out that there was a gift box for the same price that had three little bottles of different varieties. So, of course, I got that. And then I thought, wouldn't it be fun to have a scotch tasting party?
Oh, that's a great idea.
For people who love scotch, people either seem to love it or hate it. And
I'm in the category with you, by the way.
I hoped you would be. But then I thought, with all that scotch, we need to eat something.
Yeah.
So I was looking for some hors d'oeuvre ideas that we would still be able to discern the differences in the flavors of the scotch.
Well, the scotch is going to stand out. I mean, it's smoky and peaty, and it's pretty distinctive. And, you know, anything that's protein is going to make the scotch taste better. So what I would have is cheeses, and I would have some cured meats, but I would keep them on the quiet side so they don't, you know, overwhelm the scotch. So I would think in terms of things like creamy cheeses, believe it or not. For instance, a very young Stilton, which is now around. You want to have something like a very young sheep cheese. It could be a domestic sheep cheese.
Okay.
You know what's delicious, believe it or not? It's a very odd combination, seeming combination, is a young goat cheese.
Okay.
And you want to have crackers. You want to have a simple baguette. You want to have things that are substantial, because that scotch is really, really distinctive, and it's going to taste delicious with young cheeses.
Okay.
Believe it or not, ricotta would be wonderful.
Uh-huh.
A little bit of really fresh mozzarella, you know, the kind that comes in liquid.
Yeah, I love
it. Believe it or not, is going to be really delicious with this.
What about the meats?
Cured hams, really good hams. Something like a simple salami. Like a little bit of a summer sausage, something like that. Nothing that's heavily spiced.
Okay.
There's a wonderful Swedish potato sausage that would be just delicious with this, with a mild mustard or a slightly sweet mustard. You could also do a Jarlsberg cheese if we're going to go the Scandinavian route.
Great. I'll have to go into Asheville and see what I can find.
Oh, you're going to find a lot in Asheville.
I know where to go.
Okay. Hey, and enjoy the tasting.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome. Bye. 800-537-5252. Friend us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Shoot us an email, splitatable.org. There's an outfit in Washington, D.C. that delivers some 6,000 meals a day. Now, it's not the Pentagon. In fact, it's nothing to do with the government. These meals are produced by a nonprofit, D.C. Central Kitchen. And the meals go to people in need and to district public schools. The kitchen does that and a great deal more. Well, Mike Curtin is CEO of DC Central Kitchen. Mike, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn. Thank you for having me.
Well, Mike, what exactly does DC Central Kitchen do?
Well, you mentioned the meals, and that's a lot of what people know us for.
Right.
But in addition to that, and really at the heart of what we're doing, is our culinary job training program for men and women coming out of prison, in recovery from addiction, homeless, chronically unemployed. So we put them in a place where they have an opportunity to break that cycle of homelessness, hunger, and poverty on their own.
So essentially, it's training them to cook? Is that the idea?
Right. Well, we realize that one of the wonderful things about the hospitality business is there are always jobs there. And it's probably one of the only businesses still existing where you can start at the very bottom and end up at the very top if you're willing to put in the hard work and the effort.
Uh-huh.
And so we're taking folks that have faced unimaginable obstacles, sadly many of them they're by their own doing, but have come to a point in their lives when they want a change, they want to live self-sufficiency, they want to be back with their families, they want to be part of the community. And this is a great avenue for us to do that.
And then you have a program where you're working with the public school system and doing lunch?
Right. In addition to running the social service programs, we do between $4.5 and $5 million a year in business, hospitality business, social enterprise, with a focus on the community, starting years ago with catering and now evolving into school food, where we are producing about 4,000 meals just for schools a day, scratch-cooked, locally sourced, again, using graduates of our program, providing healthy, fresh, nutritious foods for students in the D.C. area.
Wait a minute. You're supplying public schools with healthy, locally sourced food under the budget that's allowed for school lunch by the government?
We are close. The district enacted legislation on top of the federal school lunch legislation this year, which provided for a little bit extra money above the federal subsidy.
Uh-huh.
We're still close. The federal number is roughly $2.80. If we could get a bit over $3 and some change, is really where we need to be, and I think we would like to see us as a country. Again, all the food we're using nothing frozen, nothing processed, nothing out of a box. It's about 40% of the product, produce, dairy, and protein is local, and it's all scratch-cooked.
All right, but wait a minute. How do you pull this off?
Well, you know, the kitchen has been doing things for 23 years that people didn't think we could do, or when we proposed them originally, when Robert Egger proposed the kitchen 23 years ago, people just thought it was insane, the idea of using food that was going to be thrown away, using people that had been marginalized or thrown away, using kitchens that weren't being used to create this model of social change. People thought he was nuts. And so that's been the inspiration for us for many, many years. And when we started doing this, you know, this is possible. And one of the outlets that we've used, Lynn, is working directly with farmers and growers and saying, look, what about the produce that for aesthetic, geometric, or distribution reasons, you can't get off of your farm. Stuff that is perfectly good, it might be too big or too small, maybe funny looking, or they don't have the distribution mechanisms to get stuff out of, say, the Shenandoah Valley. But if we bring our trucks there and pay a reasonable price for this food, it's abundant. And farmers have wanted to be in this business with us, and so in essence, we've created our own commodity market using local products so we could get it into these systems at a reasonable price.
So essentially, it sounds like you're running a nonprofit charitable organization the way you would run a business.
Exactly. And you know, we say this often, that we're a $10 million business. The product that we sell happens to be empowerment, but it is indeed a business. Huh. And we need to think that way in order to provide the services that we do. And our hope is that as we continue to do these kinds of programs and show that they can be successful, that businesses then in turn may start to think a little bit more like a nonprofit. So if we can get these two ends of the spectrum sort of pushed together in the middle and blur this line of .org versus .com or for-profit versus nonprofit, we can all come out with better results.
Well, Mike, thanks for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Lynn.
Mike Curtin is CEO of DC Central Kitchen. Now, for more information, go to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Now, remember, you can connect with us any way you want. Friend us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Call us, 800-537-5252, or send us an email, splendidtable.org. You have a great weekend. Let me leave you with this from the baseball player Yogi Berra, who said, "You'd better cut the pizza into four pieces because I'm not hungry enough to eat six." Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Head to our website to get information on anything you heard here today, browse our recipes, visit our online store, and get registered for our free podcasts, weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and monthly book giveaway. You're going to find it all at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Noel Clark. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.